Yeah, you know the Night and Day version on the Red Hot and Blue album?
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
quite danceable, with a bit of technology, and brand new
yes.
for the listeners
yeah.
who didn't hear anything from you two for a long time.
Yeah.
So was that cover version the spark?
Well, it wasn't so much the spark, but we had started on our own record. We'd started, and then when that project came in, we said, well, let's experiment with this rather than trying to do it quickly and get it out the way and go back to our own record. We said, no, we'll experiment with it. We'll kind of program some drum patterns in. We'll put some keyboards down. And I suppose that was, rather than the spark, it was the time when we said, well, we can take a song anywhere we want to go with it. And that's what we did with Night and Day. Was just use the studio to create sounds and atmospheres that made the music come from a different place.
The attitude of the band has changed a lot. You seem to be more serious at 20 than you are today at 30.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, when we were 20, we didn't really know or understand very much, and you know, it was a serious time for us to try and learn and, you know, find out about what was happening. I think it must be the same probably for every 20-year-old. And then when you get to 30 and you realize, hey, this is rock and roll,
yeah.
It's hard to be as serious about it. You can be serious about your work, but I think as a lifestyle, getting in and out of planes and limousines and playing in front of 20,000
yeah.
people every night, it's hard to be too serious.
Is it possible to get bored of this? To play in front of so many people and limousines?
I don't know if bored is the right word. I think maybe there comes a point where it takes on too much energy and you might want to concentrate more on the studio, but for the time being, you know, it's nice to be out. I mean, we haven't really been touring like this for 5 years, so it's still kind of quite new to us.
But there's such a big success, can make someone cynical about his work. I think that there is a bit of cynism, a lot of cynism in the new album, in the attitude, the image.
I don't know if it's cynicism or if it's just, you know, realizing that there are certain things that you just can't change.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't please everyone all the time. Therefore, perhaps you shouldn't try.
Mm-hmm.
And you should just concentrate on what you can do and what you are good at. And that was sort of like how the record happened. I mean, when we first came out, said we want to release the fly as the first single.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Crazy, you can't do that. We said, well, we want to do it. You know, we want to
yeah.
put it out. And it was the right thing for us to do. But if we'd listened to other people, they'd have probably said, you've got to go with one or something.
Also a big difference between the, let's say, the U2 before Acton Baby and after Acton Baby. In the past, you seem to be a very, a band from the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And now much more a band from the brain, from the head. You know what I mean?
I think there's both, you know. I think you can take songs like One and You're So Cruel, Trying to Throw Your Arms Around the World, Wild Horses,
mm-hmm.
and I think they're heart songs. And I think, you know, something like Real Thing or The Fly or
yeah.
Zoo Station is maybe more of a head thing, but I just think it's the band has broadened itself.
Yeah.
I mean, when we did Rattle and Hum, there were quite a lot of different ideas on that record. I know everyone talks about the kind of blues and gospel side of it. That was something that we wanted to explore just from the point of view of songwriting, but also on that record you have things like All I Want Is You,
yeah.
and God Part 2, and Hawkman, which are you know, they're quite close to where we are now. God Part 2 is, you know, quite an up song. It would sound kind of a part of Action Baby.
But attitude has always been very important, but it seemed natural in the past. And today, attitude seems to be the result of a strategy. Less spontaneous.
Well, it's a different kind of a thing that we're going for now. I agree that in the past, you know, when you went to a concert, you know, Bono is one of the greatest soul singers, and he can sing right from the heart. But with this Zoo TV show, what we wanted was to just focus on what the video age has done to music, in a sense, and what MTV has done, where it's all fast images, it's text, it's information, and we felt that when people come to a U2 show, they expect all that heart and soul, and I think it's in the show as well, but this is something else that we wanted to give people, so that they weren't just coming to another concert, that they were actually coming to something and they were having to think of it and go, whoa, what's going on here? This is not, you know, what bands do.
But for instance, these photos you've made with Cobain, dressed up like drag queens, it wasn't even, you couldn't believe that a couple of years ago from you two. You seem that you act as if you had to destroy something, like a phoenix, you know, you put the you put it in, you burn it, and then it rebirths, new rebirth. Or
well, I think we had to send a very strong signal to the press and the public that they had only been concentrating on one side of YouTube, you know, in a public sense, and that was the Joshua Tree. It was the series. It was Amnesty International, it was saving the world. And that's fine, we still feel the same way about those things. But we also wanted to show people that that wasn't the only facet to YouTube, that there was humour and fun in our lives and in our work. And we kind of said to Anton, look, we don't want you to take serious photographs. We want to have fun in our photographs. And that's why a lot of the locations for the photographs were in warm places in Europe. We were in Morocco, and we were in Santa Cruz, and we had 3 or 4 days in each place, and it was just hanging out, you know, not being too serious, and being in America.
About the commitment of the band, you're going to do a Greenpeace concert in Manchester on the 20th of
That's
June,
right,
but in front of 100,000 people. So it will be the stadium concert,
well,
or it will be the Zoo TV?
Well, we've actually changed that. It will be Zoo TV, and it will be indoors. We thought about doing it outdoors, and we kind of realized that taking this show outdoors to that many people would not really be satisfying. We couldn't really project it. So we said, look, we'd do it as an indoor show, and you know, maybe in the future we'll do a big show outdoors for Greenpeace.
In Musician, the magazine, Edge gave an interview, and if you can read between the lines, he seemed to say that during the period of silence, the group split up and then reformed with the same musicians. What's your version of the facts?
I think there is truth in that. I think what happened was, after Rattle and Hum, the film had come out and the record had come out and everything, I think we realized we were at the end of a creative road, or at the beginning of another road. And we sort of had a decision, we had a choice to make at that point, which was carry on as things are, or, you know, change how we come to the music. And I think we just decided that what excited us most was a lot of the new music that was being played by the young bands. To us it was a bit like the excitement we felt when we discovered punk rock, and we said this is the direction we want to go, we want to follow this through, because traditionally in music, everyone, when a new piece of equipment comes along, the first time when the electric guitar was invented, everyone said, it'll never last, it'll be gone next year, and then somebody invented the amplifier and the wah-wah pedal, and, you know, I think you've got to, if you're working in popular music, you've got to take on anything that is available to change sound, because that's what it is. Yeah. You're playing with sound, and you have to keep looking for different sounds.
But for instance, for the moment, what are your favorite bands or acts, as most of the bands today are not bands anymore, but just acts?
Well, it kind of changes. I mean, I love people like Smashing Pumpkins and Pearl Jam and Nirvana, you know, those guitar bands.
Not very techno.
No, they're not very techno, but they're working with good sounds, and they're kind of, their songwriting is quite well developed.
Mm-hmm.
And then, for instance, I listened to that new Beastie Boys album, which is really good.
Mm-hmm.
And then another band I got recently called Black Sheep from LA.
Yeah.
The Disciples of Hypocrisy, they're out of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been into acid house?
I've been to a couple of clubs in New York. There's a place called the Red Zone,
mm-hmm.
which they're doing great things in there. And the Power, I think the Powerhouse as well, where the DJs are just mixing. Like, they've got almost the same equipment as a band up there. They've got drum machines and sequences, mm-hmm. and they've got the records going as well, and they're playing extra stuff on it, and sampling stuff and playing it over. It's really good. It's really exciting.
They are doing more live stuff than some artists touring all over the world.
That's right. I mean, it's really creative. Mm-hmm. And the night I was in, it just felt like this was where music had to be, because you were in an environment where normally people just play records, but there was like just all these different sounds happening and coming in and out, and it was like 3D. It was like being on acid,
mm-hmm.
Without the acid.
Yeah. Is it true that basically Acton Baby should have been called Hedam?
It was an idea. That was why I did this photograph.
Yeah, yeah.
It was going to be called Adam, and it would just have been me on the cover. But after a while, you know, we went off the idea. It wasn't right for this record, you know. Maybe right for another one, but Acton Baby seemed to be a better idea.
During the last 2 years, you've been the shocking member of U2 with the drug affair we've read in the press, and then that photo on the cover of Acton Baby.
Yeah, I didn't plan any of it just kind of happened to me. I don't know, I mean, yeah, I suppose things have happened to me a bit, but
you mean that Cobain did that photo by surprise? No.
No, we talked about it, and then one afternoon at the end of a photo session he said, come on, let's do that photo, it'll only take 10 minutes. So that's what we did.
Yeah. And you wanted it to be on the cover of the album?
Yeah, it would have been good on the cover of the album, mm-hmm. except in America they censored it.
As usual.
Yeah, really stupid.
Would you say that Acton Baby is a typical Berlin album? I mean, in the tradition of Lou Reed, Bowie, you know, even Depeche Mode?
I wouldn't say it's a typical Berlin record. I think there's a lot of warmth in it as well. But it certainly has some of the classic Berlin album feel and sound to it, yeah.
Because you can't escape the city when you're working in Berlin?
I don't know what it is. It's a city where it's very Germanic, mm-hmm. on the one hand, you know, very strict and disciplined. And then on the other hand, you have all this kind of amazing stuff happening at night, and sort of artists and ideas and scenes going on. So it's like you have the two things, and the day is very different to the night.
I think that on the, as I saw the stage set with the travelers and so on, there is a lot of semiology in the new U2 stage equipment. Trabant mean Eastern Europe with all the problems, the fall of the Berlin Wall and so on, but also with the artists, the painters who painted the Trabants, and all the TV, MTV on stage meeting the Trabants with a big mix of everything from all over the world, with all the channels from all over the world. I think that some, I don't know who, maybe it's a collective world, but someone very clever has thought about all this.
Well, I mean, it starts with the band, and we sort of have an idea before we sort of even go into a record of, you know, what the feeling is that we want at the end of the day, and then we just kind of follow those feelings along the way. And you know, at first the idea of working with video on stage, we weren't sure about it because, you know, it could take away from the band, from the performance. And then we said, well, let's use it in a different way, rather than, because we knew that we'd be having video reinforcement, because that's very standard. So we said, well, we don't want the video reinforcement, that's kind of boring. What else can we do with it? And then we discovered the video walls, and Brian Eno got involved, and he said, well, look, we can do these sort of things with this setup and that sort of thing with that setup. Then we met a video artist called Mark Pellington, who works out of New York, and he sort of cut a few things together for us. And then it emerged that, you know, the visual element to the show really did work. And then we thought, well, there's a whole communications thing that we can tap into with a satellite dish. And we also have a phone up there, so sometimes Vonna will use the phone.
To order pizza, so.
The pizza, or ring the White House, or, you know, on the shopping channel.
I think all that is not as innocent as it seems to be. It's very, very clever. It's very subversive.
Yeah. It's
not just entertainment.
No, there is mischief and subversion involved as well. I think.
Do you think that you are manipulating the audience during the tour?
I don't know if we are, or if the TV is.
Maybe is it the response from you too? You have been trapped in your success, and maybe manipulated by audience, press, and so on. And this is our response. Now we are going to manipulate the audience and the press. Revenge!
It's a good way of looking at it. I hadn't thought it out like that, but yeah, maybe it is a way of us getting a bit more freedom to do whatever we want to, rather than feeling that we have a responsibility. Which, I mean, even if you say you don't have any responsibility, it's kind of not really true. Of course you have responsibility, but it's nice to pretend that you can escape from it sometimes.
Have you ever underestimated the problems of being famous, of being mainstream all over the world?
It's kind of a shock how popular U2 is. It has positive sides and negative sides. The negative side is sometimes it's very hard to have any real privacy, and you know, that
that can be bad if you're having a bad day, and like everyone does, and people are coming up to you when you're trying to sort of have a drink with your friends or your girlfriend or something like that. But there are many other times when people come up to you and they're very nice, and they lift your spirits. You know, you can be having a bad day and you meet someone and they say something, and it can be a really good thing as well.
Could you imagine your life without YouTube?
It would be hard, but I think that would never really be possible, because I think YouTube is so much a part of all of the band's lives that even if the band wasn't working, there would still be that bond between the four people, and I'm sure we'd still get together every 2 or 3 months, just socially, if not to work.
Are you proud to say today that you two are still a band? I mean, in your position, most of the bands or the groups are just 3, 2, 4, 5 individuals working together.
It is something that we are proud of. Most bands, when they get to this period of their careers, usually start making bad records and not being very interesting, and eventually they break up. I think we've been very fortunate that everyone in the band wants to preserve what the band has and what the band is. So we work quite hard between ourselves to try and keep that chemistry alive and not let the band go stale.
Is the life you live today close to what you imagined when you were 17 or 18 and started?
I work a lot harder than I thought I ever
would. Really? Do you think that you gave more to you two than you two gave to you? I mean, on a personal level?
No, I think no? I think it's a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
I get a lot out of you two. It does take up a lot of time and energy to do that. But I think, you know, probably your job or anyone else's job, you only get, I don't know, 1 month a year off or something. The rest of the time you're working. So I always thought that being in a band, you kind of have more time off and less time working, but it's kind of the other way around.
This is the same question, but with different words. Would you say that the greatest happiness in your life are coming from a band?
On certain levels,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they're very personal levels. I mean, I think the greatest happiness in the band sometimes is when you play a great show or you write a great song. You know, that's very satisfying. Some of the other things, like how many million records you sell, doesn't really mean very much to me. Doesn't make me happy. I mean, it's nice to sell, I don't know, they said something like 15 million of the Joshua Tree, but and I think 8 million of Acton Baby so far. But it's only figures, it doesn't really mean anything.
What's it most important to you today? Selling another 1,000 copy or having a good review in a hardcore fanzine?
I think having a good review in a hardcore fanzine, because it means that what we're doing is relevant to people who are really kind of in touch and, you know, making changes. You know, I think it's good to be away from the establishment. I mean, Rolling Stone or Q is the establishment, but they're never really going to take on any new ideas. Whereas I think hardcore fanzines are out there looking for new things to discover. And that's the type of contact and feedback that we want, because it's not always possible for us to be out there finding things. I mean, that is one of the drawbacks of fame, if you like, is that you gradually, if you're not careful, become removed from the culture that you started out with. because you don't go to clubs as often as you used to, and you're not in record shops all the time looking for things. So it's quite hard to kind of keep one foot in the establishment and the other one.
Tell me, because you remained silent when the Achtung Baby album was released, there was a lot of speculation on the band in the press, and a lot of people used to say that Paul McGuinness was the brain who kept under control all the new stuff in the band, new attitude, new image and so on. Do you have something to say about that?
Well, that's not really true. That's not the way it happens. Paul is never really around in the studio or in the early days because he likes energy and momentum, and at that stage there's very little to hear, and we're still working on ideas and, you know, trying to fit everything together. And once we've got it clear in our mind what the musical direction is, then Paul hears it and he can understand what we're doing then, you know. And then he goes and tells everyone about it.
Why have you decided to release the album in such a discreet way? No decadent party in Dublin, no worldwide press conference by satellite and so on. These are the first interviews you are giving.
Well, when we finished the record and listened to it, you know, as one big thing, we said this record has to be able to stand up for itself. You know, we don't want to have to talk people into listening to it. People should go away and listen to it and come to their own conclusion. And I think that was the right thing to do for the record, because sometimes records can be so sort of hyped and there can be so much publicity about them that people don't actually listen to the record, they just buy it because you know, everyone is telling them to do it. And we wanted people to listen to this record.
Because of the fact that you didn't want to make so much promo interviews and photo sessions and so on, did you mention that the sales of the record was not doing as well as another record with an average promo?
Well, we never
did you pay the bill, I mean.
Well, we never thought that Achtung Baby was going to be an easy record. We knew that it wasn't going to be like Joshua Tree. It didn't have those kind of big hits on it that radio like. You know, it was a hard record for radio to program. It's a hard record for people to listen to. But it was the record we wanted to make, so you live with those consequences. And as I said before, you know, selling 15 million or 18 or 20 million is never really important to us, as long as we think the record is good.
In your position. But your position is comfortable because of that, but you're also under pressure.
I think, yeah, you're under pressure because record companies like to sell lots of records. Which is fair enough, that's their job, you know. But we'll see. We'll see how this record does in the long term.
It's
still very early.
Do you already get some ideas of what the future of U2 is going to be?
Yeah, we have a few ideas.
It seems that Achtung Baby is U2 Chapter 2. Let's start something new.
Yeah, I think, you know, Achtung is the beginning of this new. And the next record, it's hard to say until it started, but I think it will follow on from Achtung. It'll probably be another rock record with, you know, hopefully even louder guitars.
And maybe one day another album, let's say U2 First Period Revival. Do you still feel comfortable with songs like Sunday Bloody Sunday or Gloria, as you don't play it anymore on stage? For the moment
we don't play them. I think if we do play them again, they will be in a different form. I think when we wrote and performed those songs in the 80s, I mean, that was 83, 84, I think. We were 24. And I think if we play them again, we have to play them.